Accession number 18822, reel 16.
Reel 16.
It runs, Watarana Wanimutum, one day a certain man, Yabadamamaki, he gave cause for astonishment. Yaitagaya wa mutane, he said to all and sundry, Kuzum wi salami, come let us make our farewells. Ranjajivare namutu, on the day of the great feast I am going to die. To mutum duyawa sumbashi sadaka, dumin ialinsu. Gullible people gave him money to pass on to the relatives who had died. To Ransalaya Isu, the day of the great feast arrived. Jama'a Yazo Dakinsa, a great crowd came round his hut. Yafito Kofa, the man came out of his door. Yaga Jama'a, he saw the great crowd. And Yache, Na'a Faza Mutua, no, I am postponing my death. End of story. The Hausa regarded that as wildly funny. There were all these gullible people handing their money on to this con man, you see. And, but I was on to expatriate living conditions. The upcountry, just mud and thatch huts, a little basic furniture, a couple of three or four camp chairs, a table. I think we might have had mosquito nets issued later on, although I think to start with you had to get your own. Because conditions were bush, I can remember Governor Adams on transfer from Malaya, I was shown the residency at Sokoto, and he said, "Good God, is that the residency? I wouldn't insult a Malayan first to a cadet with a shack like that." So our building, our living conditions were very rough and primitive in comparison with, say, Malaya for a start, or partly because pre-war, no wives or children ever came out. Very occasionally, a wife would get special permission, come out in, say, November, and leave at the end of February. And it would be just possible to survive the climate and the conditions for the winter. But that was rare, and certainly we never brought children out. So that we'd inherited substandard living quarters, suitable only for a bachelor who was, in any case, spending 20 days a month out on tour. I described mosquitoes and sandflies biting like starving dogs, and it happened very seldom. In 20 years, one cobra, one python, and one scorpion sting. I mean, it's not too bad, but people, post-war, chaps on their salary could not afford to maintain a wife and children, if any, in a separate establishment in England, so the wives came out. And these chaps quietly did their 3 years, two 18-month tours, that was just about enabled you to pay off an advance to buy a car, and you'd be entitled to generous 18 weeks leave on full pay, and with that they would quietly resign. There was a steady stream of people resigning, so that one MP once asked a parliamentary question, I'm not quite sure who put him up to this, how many had resigned from Nigeria, and the answer was, we don't know, because pre-war nobody ever resigned. It was a you know, a prestigious, well-paid job that you started at 450 a year, and that was a lot of money in, say, 1930s. And but you still started at 450 in the post-war period when it was worth much less. And what was the climate and the problem of wives and children? People were just getting themselves confirmed appointment, passing all their exams, and just as they were beginning to be useful, at the end of their second 18 months, just resigning. And that's why I wanted to... The kerosene-burning fridge, which was issued to everybody, was an attempt to improve conditions and prevent the steady stream of people pushing off. Another factor was bullying by residents. I once, because I was rather busy, I'd arrived at the provincial headquarters. I had to collect all my loads and organize transport and find where my steward and cook were and get things organized. And I forgot to sign the residence book. And I was made to wear a full suit with a collar and tie and walk half a mile from provincial office to the residency, solemnly sign the book and walk half a mile back wearing them. By which time, of course, my suit was just covered in sweat and had to be carefully laundered again and so on. But that was the kind of thing, the way some residents behaved. They had simply enormous powers. And there was a wretched chap called Dennis who had driven 200 miles to deal with some problem right at the end of the province on the border of French territory, and his car broke down irrevocably. What we did was we were given £800 loan to buy a car, and the cost of the loan was deducted in 48 monthly installments from your salary, and you also paid 3% interest. And then with a car in working order, you got so many pence a mile to cover running costs, and you had to use your car for any official duty that was needed, like this boundary difficulty miles away. And the trouble was, if your car broke down irrevocably, the roads were pretty bad. I can digress for a short while on corrugations. All roads were made of laterite. Laterite is a kind of earth that enables you a road to stay viable in the wet season. I think it has a high iron content or something like that. But when there's traffic, particularly lorries, it rucks up into corrugations. So every yard you drive, your car is going like that. If you can go really fast, take a chance, you won't hit an oncoming lorry around the next corner or have an accident by going too fast. You could just about go fast enough to avoid the corrugating effect. But generally, your car wouldn't last more than 4 years. No insurance company would insure you if your car had been 4 years in Nigeria. After 4 years, you couldn't get an insurance, so you had to buy a new one. And Dennis's car had broken down, and the resident was rough. As far as he was concerned, Unilever's breakdown van would drive out 200 miles to where the car was and tow it back 200 miles. But it was going to cost more than £1 a mile to do that, which is practically getting on for a year's salary for a Dennis man. So there was a kindly senior district officer, and he had some Byzantine Machiavellian thing. It was ludicrous. He got our Polish doctor, who didn't give a damn for anybody, to certify that Dennis Mann was suffering from PUO, pyrexia of unknown origin, which meant a slight fever, which could be anything from malaria onwards. And he, armed with that, the kindly SDO got the, what was said to be the first available vehicle to bring him in 200 miles. But it turned out the first available vehicle was a 30-hundredweight Native Authority truck that was strong enough to tow a car for 200 miles over those rather dubious roads. And Dennis agreed not to make any claim for mileage for that 200 miles. And they were all dragged in, and Studiensky put Dennis under observation for a night or two, ostensibly for low fever, and then declared that he was all right. And in that way, because the cost of the truck was met by the Public Works Department, he didn't have to pay hundreds of pounds for having his car towed in. But it showed that powers of a resident who would quite cheerfully have said that if you can't afford £400 to have your car towed, of course the resident was never told this, it was carefully kept from him under this Byzantine plot involving medical officers and transport officers and so on, you will pay that. General orders rules that you will have one third of your monthly salary deducted until such time as the entire sum is paid off. So a resident had tremendous powers, and they could make it unpleasant for you. You could be posted with a wife and three small children. It did happen to a friend of mine, to a place called Joss, which had a very nice, better than average climate. But there was one area called Lowland, which was absolutely stinking. And the resident, as soon as he got to the provincial office, the resident said, I'm posting you to Lowland. So within about 6 weeks, he'd had to send his wife back to England and rent accommodation and so on. I had it happen to me once. That child there by the sword hilt to your left was about that old. That's my late wife and the child. And a bully called Great Batch, whose nickname was Ruthless Bruce, he posted me to an area called Bew, which was well known. It was a volcanic area, and there were two peculiar characteristics. Any water, ponds, and a small lake were infested with crocodiles, and the water was full of magnesium sulfate. So that if you gave that to a European child, if she drank it, she immediately got diarrhea. And that any child with diarrhea would weaken and catch anything that was going. So I had to pay Nigerian Railways to send cases of 48 bottles of potable water in a case at my own expense, hundreds of miles from Kano to this station in Bew, and make damn sure that no, the servants and nobody made her drink anything else except from these bottles, which were, the case was clearly marked potable. But that was Great Batch. I think he had a plan. I think at the time self-government had arrived, but he was the most senior British officer still in Nigeria, northern Nigeria, and he had a plan to, there were about 200 British officers still remaining in the administration, he had a plan to sack, make redundant 170 of them, and have 30 picked men one for each of the 12 provinces and one for each of the 12 ministries and half a dozen leave and sick reliefs. 30, and out of 200, the 30 picked men, they were first class. And so he'd get rid of a lot of less than satisfactory staff and have absolutely hand-picked men to deal with. And he thought that if he posted me to Bew, the risk of diarrhea and the child's illness was so great that I would throw my hand in and resign. By then, we were all entitled to draw redundancy pay and accrued pension and bailout. But I managed to dig my toes in and stay on a bit. But it just... there was it just gives you some idea of the powers of a resident. The wife of a chap, she was called Patricia. On the admin training course, she was allowed to attend the language classes in School of African Studies and to come out with her husband. And she passed the language exam with flying colours and accompanied her husband on these tours, but she caught smallpox. And she had a filming row with the resident, saying that these compulsory 20-night-a-month tours were ridiculous. The native courts knew you were coming, and they'd carefully take out and hide any cases or documents that would cause some trouble. And the treasurer would quietly put back any money he fiddled so that the right amount was there the day you arrived, and then take it out again the day after. And that all this, and sort of whatever, all of them, the dispensers, school teachers, road gangs, would all be seen busily working for the day you arrived, and mysteriously pushing off to work on their own farms the day you left. So the whole thing was pointless. It amounted to merely showing the flag and nothing else. And it was a misuse of the administrative resource staff that were posted to the province. There was a really flaming row because no resident had ever had anybody argue back at them like that. And she left, never came back to Nigeria again, became a very successful education administrator in the in England. But that's just to give you an idea. You could have difficulty with this kind of bullying. However, there was very generous leaves. At the end of an 18-month tour, you got not only 1 week on full pay for each completed month in Nigeria, that's 18 weeks, but also 2 weeks aboard the mail boat Lagos-Liverpool and 2 weeks back also on full pay. That was 22 weeks on full pay. And since the boats only went down, sailed once a fortnight, you'd probably get an extra 4 or 5 days waiting for the next boat to leave Liverpool. That meant at least 5 months on full pay every 18 months. And that was fabulous. Before I was married, I joined the paratroops. The artist rifles were formed into a parachute unit called the 21st SAS, and I joined them, and I managed to get a couple of leaves and qualified as a paratrooper and took part in training, things like cliff climbing, and we had a chap keen on small boats, and we did landing exercise near Portsmouth. It kept one off the streets, kept one out of pubs, if you had an activity like that. And I had a first-class German ex-SS sergeant called Neukel, who was a Bergführer und Skilehrer, trained for mountain climbing and skiing, and I'd stay as long as I could afford with him. And his speciality were those quite frightening limestone cliffs near St. Johann in Tyrol, the Kaisergebirgen. You could look down through your, between your knees, 300 metres, 1,000 foot practically, straight down these cliffs. Plenty of holes being limestone, but quite frightening to look down 1,000 foot just air. Depending on what time of year I'm in, he either improved my skiing or took me up these cliffs, and that was a very good way of passing one's leave. Although once I slipped and fell on a grade 5 pitch and my rope swung away from any possible handholds, and as I hung there, Neuchel said, "Come in quick, I am not strong to hold you so long." But eventually he managed to do a belay and lower another rope with a waistband and snap link. And I managed somehow to get that round my waist and was dragged up to safety. And I also did a glider course but failed. I really hadn't the ability to do a solo landing. So I did all that kind of thing on these generous leaves. But of course, when I got married and produced family, there was no time for this kind of activity. Angela and I had some absolutely fabulous leaves around places like Granada and Seville and Tuscany and Venice and Siena. Greece from the eastern coast right as far as islands like Mykonos. It was terribly good because she had an informed interest in almost everything and could explain how the Sienese primitives developed from the rigorous assumptions of Byzantine art, and the difference between and the significance of the Guelph and Ghibelline battlements. She could talk lucidly and interestingly on almost everything. So that took care, that and the children took care of all my leaves after that. So everybody sort of put up with everything and lived for the day when you would get 22 weeks leave on full pay. But one of the troubles was upheavals. 9 times I was ordered to make a permanent move, and that meant packing everything up you'd got and putting it aboard lorries onto trains and travelling across Nigeria for 3, 4, or 5 days and opening up shop somewhere else. I've described Bew, where there was magnesium sulfate. I've described Adoma, which is a punishment station. I've described Zuru, which was, in comparison, fairly idyllic. And I had a tour in the Loran province, which were Yoruba speakers, but deemed to be part of northern Nigeria, and everything was in Hausa, which had certain problems. And I had 3 years in Lagos, which was lovely. There was a proper bungalow with electricity and running water, and I played. I eventually won the Colony Squash Championship in 1956 and played a lot of chess and bridge. And every day, when the office closed mid-afternoon, one can go down to the beach and have an idyllic swim, followed by back, a shower, a game of squash, bridge and chess, and we every year we put on something, whether it was Pirates or Gilbert's or Mikado or something, and every year we sang two parts of the Messiah in rotation. So we had choirs, and it was three absolutely idyllic years. There are a lot of girls there because no Nigerians, or very few Nigerians, could do shorthand typing. If they could had enough command of English to do shorthand typing, they had enough command of English to get a better job. So the government had to send out English girls. Their only common factor was that they were over 21. They could do shorthand 60, shorthand 120, and 60, and typing 60. And there were some very attractive girls among them. So, what with the choirs and the bathing and the sports and so on, and the electricity and the running water, and it was three blissful years. But that was my limit. Other moves were awful, with small children and days of travelling and opening up somewhere different, and so on. It was an upheaval that nobody liked. And another factor was it took me years to get promoted to a reasonable grade, so that my wife Angela had to suffer my status. When it was a question of a decent cabin on the boat going on leave or returning from leave, or the size and quality of the quarter you were allocated, because I had lost seniority and had written warnings and no brownie points, I didn't get promoted, and we suffered for quite a long time having to concede to people she didn't think much of better cabins and quarters because of my status. Anyway, although there were enormous difficulties, at least one could look forward to a long and fabulous leave. Right, now that brings us to self-government. There'd been grudging progress made. Governor Macpherson was obliged to draft and sign the 1951 political agreement with the Nigerians, and then the 1954, and then the 1957, and that ushered in independence for the regions, but foreign affairs and the armed forces and one or two other, I think law, were retained by the British to control. But by 1960, everything was handed over. And the Muslims begged all the